here, far from town. I figured this would be the safest place for now.
The man nodded. You get ID that verifies you live out here?
Bob nodded as he reached for his wallet.
Sure.
Taking the ID, the man examined it briefly and handed it back. With a nod of his head, he said,
There's another roadblock up there.
I'll radio them and let them know you're coming through.
We're just trying to protect our homes, is all.
Gene scooted forward.
Have you heard about Texas?
The man shook his head.
No, what's up there?
They told the feds to stuff their martial law up their ass.
They severed the power grid where it left the state and have mobilized the Texas National Guard to protect the state. The commander of Fort Hood even placed the base under the control of the governor. The man nodded, obviously thinking.
Interesting. How'd you hear that?
Ham radio? You guys have any here?
Gene asked. He shook his head.
No, wish we did.
Gene smiled.
No kill switch on those.
The man took an iPhone from a pouch in his vest.
Yeah, I remember when they came up with all that shit.
They told us it was to prevent terrorism and to fight drug traffickers. We figured it was all BS.
As the man was talking, the phone suddenly began to emit the emergency alert tone, as did everyone's in the van. As they went for their phones, the man said,
It's a text. Says there's going to be an address by the Secretary of Homeland Security today at 5.
Daniel leaned out of the window, and the man turned the phone so he could see it.
Looks like the phones are one way now, Daniel said. What do you want to bet the power comes back on sometime before 5?
Bob asked.
The man nodded and said, I bet you're right. You guys go ahead.
He turned and waved to the men behind him, and one of them climbed up onto a case front-end loader that sat in the middle of the barricade and backed it out of the way, allowing them to pass. Bob waved at the man.
Thanks. You guys take care of yourselves.
The man nodded.
We are. You do the same.
That was scary, Christy said. Bob snorted.
It could have gone a lot worse.
Gene smiled and looked at Teague.
You did good. I know you're young and you think you're 10 feet tall and bulletproof, and that your pecker is bigger than everyone else's. Hell, maybe it is. But you need to learn there's a time to fight and a time to listen. When you're running your face whole like you were, you leave nothing to the imagination of those you're talking to. They already know you're a problem, and they are then more likely to deal with it quickly. If you're quiet and just listening, they don't know what to think.
Gene tapped his head with his finger.
Use it for more than just a hat rack.
Teague seemed to take the advice to heart, much to Gene's surprise.
I need to learn to think before I start running my mouth. Thanks for keeping me in line. I promise it won't happen again.
Gene sat back and slapped his knees.
Then you and me will get on fine. Just fine.
He lifted the Mossberg and added,
And I won't have to shoot your ass with this thing.
Teague laughed.
I appreciate that, Gene. Really and truly.
The rest of the drive to Bob's went without issue. At the turnoff to North Cut Lane, they stopped for the two tractors blocking the way.
Bob quickly waved at the two men and greeted them.
Hey, Bill, Dale, how's it going?
Dale stepped up to the van, cradling an AK. He looked in and surveyed the people inside.
I see you've got some refugees.
Annoyed, Christy shot back.
We're not refugees.
Bob ignored her comment.
Glad to see you guys out here. We've passed a couple other roadblocks, people doing the same thing.
Dale shrugged.
We gotta look out for our homes.
He looked at the van and added,
Going all Mad Max?
We took precautions to get out of town.
And how was the trip out of Atlanta?
Dale asked. Bob lit a smoke before answering.
It was rough, but not as bad as it could have been. Have you seen any trouble out here?
Dale slowly shook his head and replied in a thick, slow southern drawl.
Nah, ain't no trouble out here. Just being careful is all.
Bob nodded.
That's good. Is the power on?
Dale shrugged.
Comes and goes, but your generator's running. We moved a couple fridges into your garage so we didn't lose all our food. No problem. Glad I was there for you.
Bob wagged a finger at Dale.
I told you it would come in handy.
Dale dropped his head.
I know. You was right, and I was wrong. It's all right, old buddy. Just glad we have it. At least as long as the natural gas keeps flowing.
Dale nodded.
When that runs out, I won't be able to cook anymore.
Bob laughed.
When the gas runs out, we'll have a lot more to worry about, old friend.
Dale nodded, and Bob added,
We're going to the house. I need to rest and maybe get a shower.
Dale slapped the side of the van.
Glad to see you made it out of Atlanta. Good to have you home, old buddy.
Bob waved and guided Daniel to his house. The driveway cut through a stand of trees and curved towards the house. It wasn't visible from the road. The house was a simple, wood-framed affair, with several outbuildings. It was just the kind of thing you'd expect to find in the Georgia countryside, where the driveway turned into the parking area at the house. Sat a garden plot, long ago gone fallow.
Gene grunted. Didn't figure you for the gardener type.
Bob looked at the small patch of ground where he had had great aspirations. But like many would-be gardeners, it just didn't work out.
Yeah, well, as you can see, I'm not. I tried it for a bit, just looking for a way to get out of the house, something to help lower the blood pressure. But work kept me too busy.
Daniel pulled up in front of a two-car garage door and shut the van off. He dropped his head to the steering wheel and let out a long breath. Bob got out of the van and stretched. He pointed at the house and said,
It ain't much, but mi casa is your casa.
Teague climbed out of the van and stretched as well. Everyone was stiff and tired. Not that it was a long ride, but the tension of it all had left them weary. And this was only a 30-odd mile trip. If they were going to Texas, they'd spend days in the van. Christy rolled out of the van and found Daniel on the driver's side. She wrapped him up in a hug, burying her face in his neck. He pulled her tight and buried his face in her hair. He was glad to have her, and it was coming more and more to the realization just how much he needed her. She pulled away from him. With a squint, she said, I really have to pee. He couldn't help but smile as she trotted towards the house with her knees locked together. Bob and Jean were already in the house. Teague came around to the front of the van and reached in, grabbing Bob's carton of smokes off the dash. Taking a pack, he shook out a smoke and lit it up and leaned against the fender. After taking a long drag, he looked at Daniel.
You really think that old fucker would have shot me?
Daniel leaned against the fender beside him. Taking the cigarette from Teague, he took a quick drag and handed it back. Blowing out the smoke, he said,
You know, I think he would have.
Old Gene doesn't seem to have much of a sense of humor.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Taking the cigarette again, Daniel said, You really do need to calm down. I think he's right. There's a time for confrontation, but it isn't every time.
Teague nodded. I know. Things will be different from now on. This shit is for keeps. There's no respawn.
Daniel smiled and slapped Teague on the back.
No, there's not. Come on, let's go inside and check out the house.
The two men walked into the house. Bob's place was much like his office, at least in places. In the living room,
sat a recliner with an end table beside it. The table was covered with old newspapers and overflowing ashtrays. Ashes covered the floor around the chair and the table. Numerous coffee cups sat atop the papers and filled every inch not occupied by ashtrays. The rest of the house stood in stark contrast to the recliner. It was neat and orderly. The kitchen was orderly, not a dish in the sink. The exception was the coffee pot. It looked like Bob's coffee pot at work. Grounds were spilled on the counter around it, the burner black from spilled coffee, and the pot itself looked like some sort of science experiment, but not to Bob. He referred to it as seasoning. The rest of the house was furnished in the trappings of a country home, simple, functional, and comfortable. These things stood in contrast to Bob. Christy came out of the bathroom and found Bob at the coffee pot in the kitchen. "Is there enough for me to have a cup?" As he poured a cup, he looked over his shoulder.
"Sure. How do you like it?"
"Black is fine," she replied, and looked around the kitchen. "This isn't what I'd expect for your house." Bob smiled.
"Yeah, doesn't fit the mold, does it? This was to be my escape. I wanted out of the city, something totally different. I was hoping to retire here and spend my days gardening, of all things." He laughed at himself.
Christy took her cup and held it to her mouth, smelling the thick elixir. "It's never too late to reinvent yourself." She looked around for a moment and asked, "There's no wife?" Bob laughed as he swirled his coffee.
"No, some men just aren't meant to be domesticated. Guess I'm one of them. Oh, I tried, but I poured myself into my work. It's a fault, I guess, but it's just what I am." He smiled.
Christy took a sip of her coffee. Looking over the top of the cup, she said,
"At least you're living your life on your terms."
Bob thought about that for a moment.
"I guess that's true."
He looked at her. "But it sure is lonely." Christy perked up, almost bouncing.
"Well, you're not alone anymore. You have us."
Bob laughed, doubling over. Straightening up, he said,
"Yeah, I've got Jean's weird ass, crazy cousin, and Daniel, who I just can't put my finger on."
Christy rocked back and forth.
"There's me, too."
Bob smiled.
"Indeed there is. You're a beautiful young woman. Thankfully, I'm not a creeper, and see you more as a daughter than a conquest."
Surprising Bob, Christy leaned in and hugged him.
"Well, I like having you around. There's something about you that gives me confidence."
Bob looked down at the ground. After a moment, he looked up.
"Christy, you're a sweet girl, but trust me, I'm the last man you should put your trust in. There's a number of people that will attest to that."
Christy leaned and kissed him on the cheek.
"You may have given up on yourself, but I haven't."
With her cup in hand, she exited the kitchen, leaving Bob to think about what she'd said. It had been a long time since anyone, outside of work, put their faith in him. It made him uncomfortable. He knew he'd let so many people down in the past, and yet something about her words filled him with confidence. Bob came out to the living room to find everyone there. He looked at the people he'd committed his future with.
"The house is fully backed up by the generator. The water comes from a well. So you can take a shower if you want. So long as the natural gas holds out, the house will have power."
Christy spun around to face Bob.
"In that case, I'm taking a shower."
Daniel stepped over to her and put his hands on her hips.
"Mind if I join you?"
Christy smiled a seductive smile.
"I guess you do need to get cleaned up, if you're up to it."
"Oh, I'm up to it," he replied.
Christy glanced down and smiled.
"I guess you are, big boy."
Everyone got a good laugh out of that as she took him by the hand and led him down the hall to the bathroom. As they left the living room, Bob said,
Have her home by midnight.
Daniel looked over his shoulder and smiled at Bob, who saluted him with a coffee cup. Chapter 8. After showering and spending some quality time with Christy, Daniel was sitting on Bob's back porch. It was quiet, and unlike Atlanta, there was no gunfire or smoke hanging in the air. From here, you would never know anything was going on. Bob came out onto the porch and handed Daniel a cup of coffee, then took a seat beside him. Looking around, Bob asked,
"Where's Christy?"
Daniel sipped the coffee.
"She's asleep.
I guess today was a little stressful on her. She's out of it." Bob put his feet up on the handrail that surrounded the porch.
"I know the feeling. I'm just glad to be out of Atlanta."
With a snort, Daniel replied,
"No shit."
He looked around at the quiet scene surrounding him.
"You can't even tell anything is wrong out here." "That's why I moved out here. After my last divorce, I wanted out of the rat race. The ex was all about image, and we had to have a big house and expensive cars. When we separated, I went the opposite direction. I wanted less."
With a sideways smile, Daniel asked,
"How much did she take you for?"
Bob choked on his coffee so hard it came out of his nose. He was laughing as he wiped his chin.
"Not a dime. Like I said, my last divorce. I was educated this time. There was a prenup. Oh, she was pissed when we had to sell that big house. The only thing she got to keep was her car. Everything else was liquidated, and we split it all up the middle. I didn't care if I got anything. I just didn't want her to have any of it."
Gene joined Bob and Daniel on the porch with his own cup in hand. Shortly after, Teague came out too, carrying a small AM/FM radio. He extended the antenna and placed it on the handrail.
"There's supposed to be that broadcast any minute. Thought it would be interesting to hear what they have to say."
Bob leaned forward and grabbed the radio, setting it on a local station, and placed it back on the rail. The radio was, for the moment, still dead. Nothing coming from its speakers, until the feds wanted to use the airwaves to broadcast their propaganda.
"Let's see what they have to say."
It wasn't long before the radio screeched with a carrier wave. Then, the emergency alert tone began to sound. After going through the series of tones, a computerized voice told them to stand by for an official announcement from the Secretary of Homeland Security.
"Here we go," Teague said.
"This broadcast will serve as official notice of the conditions of martial law. Ignorance is no excuse to violate the rules. Due to the rising level of violence in major cities and the local authorities' inability to control the situation, I have authorized the deployment of U.S. troops to quell the violence. With this in mind, any member of the armed forces that deserts their post will be arrested. Any members of the armed forces attempting to desert may be shot. Desertions will be handled swiftly and harshly. To that end, I have requested assistance from the UN Security Council to provide additional peacekeepers to augment our forces. In an effort to quell the violence, lethal force has been authorized for looters, groups of more than 3 people that refuse to disperse, and anyone found armed. The dusk to dawn curfew remains in effect, and any vehicle caught moving at night will be fired on. We understand people need to move about to fulfill their daily needs, but it is imperative that you take these warnings seriously. There will be no other warnings. This is the only warning that will be issued. Additionally, the transmission from amateur radios, also known as ham radios, is now, and until further notice, prohibited. These devices are being used to arrange riots and mass lootings, and we cannot allow that to continue. If you are caught with a radio, you will be arrested. A registry of licensed operators is being reviewed, and everyone on that list
will be contacted. You are hereby ordered to dismantle all antennas and render all radios inoperative. There will be zero tolerance in dealing with illegal radio transmissions. Anyone caught with one will be detained under articles of NDAA and can be held indefinitely. With that, the radio went dead. The four men stared at it, waiting for more, but nothing further was said.
"What the hell?" Daniel asked.
"Is that all?" Teague asked. Bob picked up the radio and turned it off.
"I guess so."
"They're scared. Notice how she didn't mention anything about Texas. And they're trying to keep people from using radios. They're definitely scared," Jean said.
"There's a lot she didn't mention. All she said was, we're going to start killing people," Teague said.
"We've already seen that," Daniel said.
Bob lit a smoke.
"What bothers me more than anything is what she said about military members. I think they're having a hard time getting them to toe the line."
"Makes sense," Jean said. "That's why they're bringing in UN troops."
Teague was shaking his head.
"Do they have any idea the kind of shitstorm this is going to start?"
"They didn't mention anything at all about what caused all this. Nothing. Just told us they were going to start shooting soldiers and civilians alike. It's like they're not even trying to fix things anymore," Daniel said.
"Oh, they're fixing things all right," Teague replied. "They're just working on a different problem. Us."
"Well, then what are we going to do?" Daniel asked. Bob quickly stood up.
"I say we eat. Who's hungry?"
"Stellar idea," Jean said.
"What are we having?" Teague asked.
Bob rubbed his chin.
"I was thinking I'd force thaw some steaks. Maybe have some baked potatoes and broccoli. How's that sound?"
Teague clapped his hands.
"Hell yeah."
Bob turned to the house with Jean in tow, leaving Teague and Daniel on the porch. The two sat quietly for a moment. Then Daniel asked,
"You really wanting to go to Texas?"
Teague leaned back, rocking his chair off the floor.
"I do. I think this is just the beginning. And I really don't think it's got shit to do with the banks."
"What do you think it's about, then?"
Teague looked at him, stone-faced.
"A fundamental transformation of the nation."
Daniel shook his head.
"That was Obama. This is Clinton."
With a sneer, Teague replied,
"And she's worse than he ever was.
While there was a lot he wanted to do, he was somehow restrained, maybe out of fear, maybe because the timing wasn't right. But Clinton? She's not so restrained. She and her husband are a couple of Arkansas hustlers, and they have a body count the Marine Corps envies. She's going to get even." Daniel was shaking his head.
"I know you conspiracy theory guys always think the government is out to get you, but to what end? They already have power and money. What's the aim of this kind of thing?"
Teague snorted.
"Have you been asleep? Living in a cave or something? I know you like to go hike in the woods, but you have to have seen some of the news in the world. The goal is the same as it's always been. Sure, they have money and power, but they want more. More is the goal. These people see themselves as elites, and the rest of us as commoners. They want to reinstall the royal ruling class, who are above the law, above reproach."
Again, Daniel shook his head.
"I don't know. I don't buy it."
Teague shrugged.
"What's it going to take? What do you need to see to make you believe?"
Bob came out the back door, carrying a large platter. He set it on the table and pulled the cover off a gas grill sitting against the rail. In a moment, he had the grill lit and heating up.
"Those are some damn good-looking steaks," Daniel said.
Then he looked around. "Where's Jean?" Bob was scrubbing the grill when he replied.
"He's out at the van getting his radio. He's pretty spun up about the whole ban on ham."
"That was kind of strange," Daniel said.
Why?
Teague asked.
It's the only form of communications they can't control. There's no off switch, no kill switch. Ham radio isn't like the internet or cell phones.
Can't they just jam the signal?
Bob dropped a steak onto the grill with a hiss as the meat seared against the hot metal.
It's not that easy. It's a big country, and they can't jam at all. There just isn't the equipment to do it. So they can only do small areas, maybe regional.
But they can hear what's going on and tell where it's coming from, can't they? Daniel asked. Gene came out onto the porch with a plastic tub full of radio gear and deposited it on the floor.
Sure, they can listen, and they can even get an idea where it's coming from. But there's only so much of that equipment around, though it is easy to make.
Bob looked up from the grill.
Hey, cousin, run in the kitchen and grab those beers from the fridge.
Teague leapt to his feet.
Hot damn, why didn't you say you had beer?
Stabbing his steak and turning it over, Bob replied,
Because I wanted them for dinner.
Daniel hopped up. I'm going to wake up Christy. I'm sure she's hungry. After a meal that belied the reality of the situation, the group sat on Bob's back porch, watching the sky go from blue to orange. Christy took a long drink of her beer, then asked,
Now what?
Bob lit a smoke and threw his feet back up on the rail.
Now, I say we get a good night's sleep and worry about tomorrow, tomorrow.
That works for me, Teague replied as he opened another beer. With some effort, Gene rose from his chair.
Well, I'm going to set up the radio and see what's going on.
Daniel looked over at Christy. I don't know about you, but I'm ready for bed. Christy smiled.
Me too. I say we call it a night.
Teague snorted.
Yeah, like that's what you two are going to do.
Christy stood up and Daniel wrapped an arm around her waist. He smiled at Teague.
What else would we do?
He asked with a smile. Teague snorted and took a pull off his beer as they went in the house. He knew what they were up to. Just wished he had someone around too. Bob had sat silently through the exchange. After a moment, he looked over at Teague and asked,
You need some hand lotion or something?
Teague stood up.
Fuck you, Bob.
And he stomped off the porch. Bob chuckled as he flipped the ash off his smoke and reached for the last beer. He was happy to be home and felt relaxed. Gene went out into the yard where Bob had a flagpole. He lowered Bob's flag and took a moment to fold it before carrying it back to the porch and placing it on the rail.
Turning my flagpole into an antenna? Bob asked.
Gene nodded.
Yeah, I'm going to run two wires up and stake them out to the side. Not perfect, but it should work well enough.
Gene went out and connected the splitter to the rope with a heavy rubber band and pulled it up. He then pulled the two ends of the antenna out and staked them into the ground using a couple of wood stakes he made from fallen limbs in the yard. He then ran the center point of the antenna back to the porch where the radio sat and connected it to the antenna tuner. Once the antenna was connected, Gene pulled a chair up to the small plastic table and sat down. After a few minutes to configure the radio, voices began to appear out of the ether.
Guess those old hams don't much give a shit about the ban on transmitting, Bob said.
Gene was focused on the radio.
Nope. The feds can kiss my ass. Who the hell do they think they are to tell us we can't use radios? The bastards already killed all the other forms of communication. They're just pissed they can't turn this one off.
Flipping a bud off the porch, a bad habit, but it was his place. Bob said,
Yeah, you'd think during their little broadcasts they'd give out useful info. Maybe places to get food or water, medical care, something that would help people.
but all they do is issue threats.
Government is violence, my friend. That's the only thing they know. Anyone or anything that doesn't go with the program will be dealt with violently.
Bob grunted.
They do have a monopoly on murder.
Gene looked at him.
No, but they want one. They're afraid when they don't have total control. And right now, they're really afraid.
Gene slowly went through the bands. Whenever he heard someone, he'd pause for a moment and listen. Most of what they heard was the same. People were talking about the location of things like food and fuel. It seemed everyone was looking for these two things. There was also a lot of talk about cash, or the lack of it. Gene listened for a while to a group talking about the lack of currency. These guys were pissed that they had so much money in the bank and couldn't access it. They were indignant about the fact the government had the nerve to prevent them from accessing their money. After listening to the exchange, Gene chuckled and picked up his mic. Keying the mic, he said,
"That's because when you put money in the bank, it no longer belongs to you. It belongs to the bank."
Gene laughed as he released the PTT. An operator on the other end jumped in immediately.
"Bullshit, it does. It's my money. I earned it, and they have no right to take it from me."
Laughing, Gene said,
"If it's yours, go get it. Do you see what I mean?"
There was a long pause. Then came a reply in a solemn voice.
"It's not right. It's just not right."
Gene keyed his mic.
"Didn't say it was right, just the way it is. Some of us have been saying this for years. They told us what they were going to do each and every time, but nothing happened. I hate to say it, but we allowed this to happen."
Bob looked over at Gene.
"A little harsh there, Gene."
Gene dropped the mic.
"Reality is a mother, Bob."
Bob sat there for a moment, then lit another smoke.
"I guess you're right. We were just too docile as a nation. Look at what the Greeks did when their banks started screwing around. They took to the streets. They let the politicians know they were pissed. That's nothing. Look at what Iceland did in 09. They actually put some bankers in jail. You know, I've thought a lot about how these people see us, and the best analogy I could come up with is bees."
Bob was confused.
"Bees? How so?"
Gene leaned back in his chair.
"Well, beekeepers keep their bees in a hive. They make sure they have a place to live, and in the winter months, they even feed them. But the only reason they're there is to produce honey, which the beekeeper then harvests. The bees work hard to produce honey, only to have someone come take it. We are much the same, except the harvest we're producing is cash. We work hard to produce money, and the bankers come along and take it. It's the same thing."
Bob mulled that over. The more he thought about it, the more he realized Gene was right. Humans all over the planet, no matter the nation, were simply being farmed for cash. After a bit, Bob said,
"You know, Gene, I've never thought about it that way, but you're absolutely correct. That's exactly what they're doing to us."
Gene nodded.
"It sucks when the realization comes to you, but it's the truth."
Bob shook his head.
"Then why this?"
he asked, waving his hands over his head.
"Why all this shit that's happening now? I mean, they can't be making money off this situation."
Gene nodded his head.
"What do you think the beekeeper does with a hive that's not producing? Or one that gets invaded by some parasite?"
Bob shrugged. So Gene continued.
"They burn it. Especially the ones that get invaded by parasites. They burn the whole hive. If a hive becomes unproductive, they may add brood or a new queen. But an unproductive hive isn't left to its own devices."
Not feeling too good about where this line of thought was going,
Bob replied, "I see what you mean."
Christy lay wrapped in Daniel's arms. Her body was moist with sweat, and their skin stuck together. But Daniel didn't care. It was worth it. For both of them. He ran his hand through her hair and thought back to a conversation they'd had several months ago. She was pestering him about where their relationship was going. He'd done his best to deflect the subject at the time, but now, when it seemed everything was falling apart, it was clear to him what mattered most, and he had it in his arms.
"I love you," he said quietly.
Christy didn't reply. He felt her move ever so slightly in his arms. Burying his face in her hair, he kissed the back of her head. After a moment, she said,
"So it takes the end of the world to get you to say it?"
He smiled with more than a little shame.
"No, it's not that. It's just, I realize what's important now."
She rolled over to face him, the sheet slipping down to expose her bare shoulder and breast.
"And what is important? What we just did, or me?"
Daniel looked at her for a moment. "You're what's important to me, more than anything." Smiling, he added,
"Of course, what we just did is a fine bonus."
Christy studied his face for a moment.
"Do you really mean it? Or is this just some passing thing?
And when the lights come back on, we'll go back to the way it was." Daniel ran his hand over her face.
"No, this is for real. I'm all in. For now and forever."
Christy moved in and kissed him, deeply. He replied in kind as she pulled the sheet over their heads. Looks like she wasn't quite ready to sleep just yet. Teague sat on the porch. While he didn't have a watch, he knew it was late. A high-pressure front had moved in, and the skies were clear, and the half-moon was bright. The radio sat quietly on the table, Bob and Jean having gone to bed. Off in the distance, he heard a coyote call, to be answered by several others. Some things never change, things that aren't dependent on technology or the modern world. Listening to the yaps and yips of the excited dogs made Teague think. He needed to be like the coyote. They all need to. The coyote worked in a group. They chose their fights and avoided the ones they couldn't win. They scavenged as a practice, but would fight to kill when necessary. And they mainly came out at night. Teague nodded his head. Be the coyote, he thought. If they were going to Texas, and he, for one, really wanted to, they would need to be more like the coyote. Looking at the rail, he saw Bob Smokes sitting there and snatched the pack up. He never was much of one to smoke, but enjoyed the occasional cigarette. Shaking one out, he lit it up. Inhaling deeply, he sat back with a sense of satisfaction. Bob was dreaming of bacon and black coffee. He smiled as his eyes opened. It wasn't a dream. He could certainly smell bacon and coffee. Sitting up, he scratched his head. And as is the habit of a lifelong chain smoker, he started to cough. Once the fit passed, he quickly lit a smoke as he headed to the bathroom, scratching his ass as he went. After taking a long and very satisfying piss, he dressed and headed for the kitchen. Coming into the kitchen, he was greeted by Daniel.
Morning, Bob. Hope you don't mind us taking liberties with your kitchen.
Bob smiled.
Not at all. Been a long time since I've had a beauty in the kitchen.
Christy smiled.
Thanks, Bob.
Bob bounced his eyebrows.
I was referring to Daniel.
Daniel gave him the finger as he slid an omelet out of a pan onto a plate. Christy laughed.
That's just mean, Bob.
She looked at Daniel and added,
He's all man. Trust me on that.
Take a seat, Bob. I'll have you a plate in just a second, Daniel said.
Gene came shuffling into the kitchen as well and fell into a chair.
Any chance I could get a cup of that coffee I smell?
Sure thing, Christy said, as she poured two cups and carried them over to the table. Picking up his cup, Bob asked,
How'd you guys sleep? I'm a Navy man. When I sleep, Gene replied.
Looking at Daniel, Christy replied, We slept really well, thank you. Bob nodded and sipped his coffee. Daniel set a plate with an omelet, bacon, and toast in front of him. Bob smiled.
That looks fantastic. I didn't know you were a cook.
Returning to the stove, Daniel replied,
Actually, I'm not bad at all. I'm better on the trail, though. I like cooking over an open fire.
He's a great cook, Christy added. Once Teague showed up, everyone was there. Over a hearty breakfast, they discussed their options. The choices were to stay at Bob's, as it was far enough from the city, the group felt they would be safe. Or head for Texas. Both had their uncertainties.
But we know what's here. I mean, kind of, Christy said.
Bob nodded as he mopped his plate with a piece of toast.
Well, that's true to a degree. It seems safe enough here at the moment, but we have no idea what's coming or how long this thing will last.
Teague rocked back in his chair.
I can tell you, this isn't a short-term deal. We saw the military on the streets already. We saw what they did to that camp. I say we head to Texas. It just seems safer.
I'm with Cousin on this one, Gene said. The government has blockaded all communications. They don't want us to use ham radio. They've instituted a curfew. To paraphrase Winston Churchill, this isn't the end, but it could be the end of the beginning. What I mean is, I think this is just getting started.
It's a long way to Texas. How do we even do it? We've looked at the maps. We'd have to stay off the interstate, and that would add time and miles to the trip. It just seems that there's a shit ton of risk, Daniel said. Bob lit a smoke and blew a cloud out over the table. Christy scrunched her nose and waved the smoke away. Bob smiled.
Sorry, sweetheart. My house.
She didn't say anything, but was clearly annoyed. Bob continued.
It is a risk. A huge risk, really. But if the authorities in Texas are bucking the feds, I think that's a better place to be. Sitting here, we'll run out of food pretty soon. I would imagine that eventually they'll turn off the gas, and that means no generator. So we'll be sitting around here in the dark with no food, no water, and possibly no way out because we waited too long.
Daniel dropped a crust of toast onto his plate. I agree there are risks with both choices. I just think we need more information. I'm really worried about the drive and getting stuck or losing the van. I mean, there are bound to be desperate people on the road, and that van will be very tempting.
There are ways to deal with that, Teague said.
Like what? Daniel shot back. Teague's chair banged onto the floor.
I was up late last night, sitting on the porch. I heard a pack of coyotes and started thinking about them.
We need to be more like the coyote. Daniel was shaking his head.
What the hell does that mean?
Well, the coyote lives in a pack. It works for the benefit of the pack. They scavenge as a way of life, which we would need to do as well. They choose their fights and only take on the ones they think they can win and avoid the ones they know they can't. And most importantly, they work primarily at night, which we would also have to do. Nodding his head, Bob started to laugh. Pointing his smoke at Teague, he said,
You know, cousin, I think I may have underestimated you.
He looked around the table.
I think he's right. If we're going to make a run to Texas, this is exactly how we need to do it.
Daniel protested. But moving at night will be dangerous.
we won't be able to see much, and everyone will be able to see our headlights. We may as well play music through a loudspeaker. Raising a finger, Jean said, "There are things we can do to mitigate some of that."
"Like what?" Daniel asked.
Jean looked at Bob. "You got a laptop around here?"
Bob nodded.
"Of course."
"Good. Then I can fix it so you can drive the van in the dark with no lights on," Jean replied.
"How in the hell are you going to do that?" Daniel asked.
Jean smiled, the ends of his mustache turning up.
"Leave that to me."
Bob stubbed his cigarette out on his plate.
"I think," he said with a pause, "we need to listen to the radio today."
He nodded at Jean and continued.
"Let MacGyver here work on the van. We'll go through the house here and see what we should take with us. That way, we'll have a little more info on what's going on, and we'll be better prepared if we decide to leave."
Christy cleared her throat.
"I think Bob is right. I think we need to be ready to move, but we should get as much info as we can."
"But if Jean is going to be working on the van, who's going to man the radio?" Daniel asked.
"I will," Teague replied. "I know how to use it."
Smiling, Bob said,
"I had a feeling you did."
Daniel was thinking about the discussion. After a moment, he spoke.
"I think Jean's little project is a good idea, but it's probably best if we move during the day. At night, the government has tools to see in the dark, too. We'll be the only thing moving, and that will draw attention. If we move during the day, we'll just blend in with everyone else."
Bob nodded.
"You're probably right, but the ability to travel at night, if necessary, will be a good resource."
Christy stood up.
"I'll start going through the kitchen to see what food we can take with us."
She looked around the table.
"And since I," she caught herself and looked at Daniel, "we fixed breakfast, you guys can clean it up."
She picked up her plate and laid it in the sink before turning her attention to the pantry. Bob looked at Teague.
"Looks like you're on KP.
Teague snorted.
"My ass. Looks like we are. You wash, I'll dry."
Bob resigned himself to his fate and joined Teague at the sink. Daniel went to help Christy as they began a thorough inventory of Bob's kitchen. Jean disappeared to the garage, a space he felt more comfortable in. He was always more comfortable around tools, machines, and the inorganic than he was with people. Once the dishes were done, Teague and Bob headed to the porch and turned on the radio. Bob lit a smoke, and Teague pulled the pack he'd pinched off the rail the night before and lit one for himself. Bob looked at him and asked,
"Where did you get those?"
Taking a drag, Teague replied,
"You left them on the porch last night."
Smiling, he added, "It's a scavenger's world now."
Bob grunted. "Maybe. But don't you be scavenging in my stash."
Teague laughed.
"Don't leave them lying around."
They scanned the bands looking for voices. When they found one, Teague would pause to listen. They were hearing conversations from people in the southeast region.
Most were the same. "How is it where you are? Here's what's going on around us."
They were able to glean some info from these conversations, mainly that the closer you were to an urban area, the worse your situation was. The farther from the city centers you were, the better you fared. But that depended on how well prepared you were. They listened as one man bragged about how much food he had. He crowed about being able to survive without leaving his house for years. When the other end of the conversation told him maybe he shouldn't be saying that over the radio, the man laughed.
"I've got enough guns and ammo here to stop anyone," the man practically shouted back. "Besides, no one knows where I am."
The other side of the conversation came back with a reply.
"Maybe not, but I know you're on a heading of 271 degrees from me. Anyone can track your signal."
That was the end of the conversation. The other man never came back on the radio. Maybe he realized he was vulnerable and had said too much. Maybe he knew
The other man was right, and someone could find him. Teague snorted. He's a dumbass. Anyone could find him with the right antenna. Bob cocked his head to the side.
How?
It's not that hard. You just make a directional antenna, hold it close to your body, and turn in a circle. You'll be able to tell when the signal gets stronger. Then, you just move in that direction. Bob flicked the ash from his cigarette.
Huh. Didn't know that.
They continued to go through the frequencies, looking for more conversations. Meanwhile, Daniel and Christy wrapped up their inventory of the kitchen and came out onto the porch. Christy fell into a chair beside Bob and folded her arms over her chest. Perturbed, she asked,
How do you live in a house with so little food?
And eat that crap, Daniel added. Bob laughed and shrugged.
It's just me, and I don't need much.
Kind of fond of sardines, aren't you? Daniel asked. Smiling, Bob said,
They're easy, and I like them.
Well, I think we have all the sardines we'll need, Christy said. Bob wagged his eyebrows.
I do, anyway.
Gene came out on the porch, wiping his hands on a rag.
Hey, Bob, can I get that laptop?
Rising to his feet, Bob replied,
Sure thing, Gene.
And he headed into the house, with Gene following. Daniel looked at Teague. What'd you hear on the radio? Teague told them what they'd heard, making sure to impress on them the information they'd gleaned about what it was like in the cities and how important it was to stay away from large population centers. The three discussed their options. Christy wanted to wait a while. Teague wanted to leave right away. Daniel was on the fence. He wasn't sure what to do. Teague ran his hands through his hair.
Yeah, well, we have to make a decision soon.
Why? Daniel asked. What's the hurry? We're safe here. We've got food, water, and even power. There's no trouble out here. What's the rush? Teague didn't have an immediate response.
I guess we really don't, but I would like to get on the road.
Daniel leaned forward and rubbed his face.
I just wish we had some damn information. The worst thing is the not knowing what's going on.
I feel the same way. I just wish we knew what was happening around the country, Christy said. Bob appeared in the door and said,
Hey guys, you gotta check this out.
They followed Bob through the house and out into the garage. It was dark, with the big door closed. But there was light coming from inside the van. Gene was sitting in the driver's seat with a laptop on the dash in front of him. As they got closer, it became clear what was on the screen. It was an image of the wall in front of the van. There was a bright, nearly washed-out circle on the screen. But the tool bench that ran along the wall was clearly visible.
What the hell is that? Daniel asked.
Gene stepped out of the van and walked around to the front.
Look at the screen!
Everyone moved around until they could see the screen.
Before we left the bank, I loaded a few things into the van. While this wasn't what I was thinking at the time, it's a perfect use for the camera and infrared light I took.
Pointing at the top of the van, he said,
I mounted the camera and the light on the front of that rack up there. Using the monitor, we can drive this thing in the dark.
Teague clapped his hands.
That's genius!
Daniel pushed his way towards the driver's seat.
Let me see what it's like.
He climbed in and settled behind the wheel, as if he were driving. The view on the screen was good, though there was only a short distance to the wall in front of him.
I'd like to see what it's like outside.
Gene nodded.
I already thought of that. We'll try it after dark tonight. Take it for a spin and see how it works.
Daniel adjusted himself in the seat and pretended to be driving.
The angle is a little strange. It just doesn't feel normal to be looking to the right like this, but I think it will work. We'll find out after dark tonight, Bob said,
as Daniel got out of the van. After Gene turned everything off, the group went back out onto the porch. They spent the rest of the day listening to the radio. Gene was a master at manipulating the controls and was able to find far more conversations than Teague. Using Gene's considerable skill, they were able to gather quite a bit more intel. Gene stopped on one conversation that caught his ear, so they could listen for a while.
Completely shut down.
The whole city? How the hell do you close off a city the size of Birmingham?
With lots of tanks and machine guns, that's how. You don't dare get caught out after the curfew.
Are they shooting people?
Are they shooting people? It sounds like the Thunder Run into Baghdad.
Holy shit.
I'm serious. I've heard tank main gun rounds being fired. They ain't playing. Plus, you can hear Strikers and Bradleys working in the city. But you know what the really weird thing is?
What's that?
There are signs directing people to aid centers in the city. I mean, they're bringing people into the city, and there's all kinds of shooting going on.
Damn. How far out of town are you?
I live in Forestdale, on the northeast side. But we made a trip towards the city, during the day, of course. I'm not about to be out after the curfew. That's when you hear most of the shooting.
I hear there's lots of strange stuff going on at the airports. You seen anything strange over there?
The airport is on the other side of town. No way I'm going over there. But we have seen a lot of aircraft, military stuff.
If there's a curfew, how was you out driving around?
They don't seem to bother with you during the day. Of course, there are checkpoints on the highway. You don't want to get caught with a gun. But other than that, they let you go where you need to. I guess they figure some folks still need to work.
Good talking to you. I'm getting off here before someone kicks my door in. Stay safe out there, bud.
You too, friend.
Gene looked over at Bob.
Well, that's interesting. Sounds like we need to stay away from the interstate in large cities.
Any town. I say anything with more than one traffic signal, we go around, Teague said.
Bob flipped the ash from his ever-present cigarette. Sounds like we need to travel during the day and on secondary roads to try to avoid checkpoints. Stay away from any towns, and if it comes to it, we can travel at night as well.
Daniel stood up and leaned against the rail. If they're not messing with you during the day, we should give that a shot. With the curfew in place, any movement at night will get us in trouble.
Teague rocked his chair back. So, we're rolling up to a roadblock with a truckload of guns. That will end badly for everyone because they aren't taking me anywhere.
We need to make sure that doesn't happen, Daniel replied.
So it's settled then? We're heading to Texas? Bob asked.
The group shared looks around. It was Gene who spoke first.
I've got nothing else to do. Let's go.
Bob looked at Daniel. After all, it was his van. Finally, Daniel nodded.
I guess so.
Looking at the group, he asked, Leave in the morning?
Teague jumped up. Hell yeah, guys. Let's go to Texas.
The rest of the evening was spent ensuring the van was packed with everything they would possibly need. Gene spent time going through Bob's collection of tools. He wanted to take it all, but space was at a premium, so he was restricted to a small bag and what it could hold. Not that the additional tools were even needed. He'd already pinched tools from the bank before they left. Daniel and Christy were adding the food from the kitchen to the van, trying to find room for it all. Christy pulled a short cardboard box out from under one of the seats. Holding up a jar full of dark, thick liquid, she asked,
What the hell is in these?
Daniel took the jar and placed it back in the box.
Oh, that's something Gene made up, just in case.
Just in case of what? Daniel shrugged.
Whatever, it's napalm.
Napalm? What could we possibly need that for?
Never know when you might need to burn something.
Christy looked at the box. How did you make it? Daniel smiled like a kid recounting some forbidden chemistry experiment.
It was the coolest thing. We took styrofoam cups and added them one at a time to the jars. They were about half full of gas, and we kept dropping the cups in
until they wouldn't dissolve anymore. It's really thick and sticky, and even when it's burning, it will stick to stuff. It's really cool.
Is it safe having it in the van?
Oh, sure. I mean, as long as there's no flame around it. Christy shook her head.
Oh, that makes me feel better.
Teague and Bob went through Bob's guns. Bob lamented having to leave them, but with the guns from the bank, there was no sense in taking them all. Bob did add two, though, a Ruger 10/22 and a beautiful, brand-new Ruger Mark IV hunter pistol. They reasoned if they needed to hunt, the combination that used the same ammo could come in handy. Ammo, cleaning kits, and spare parts were loaded into the van. They added a few other things as well, like a spotting scope, binoculars, and a tripod. Gene also took the time to go over the van. He checked all the fluids and even greased the undercarriage. And he checked all the tires and added a tire plug kit and small 12-volt compressor he'd found when rummaging around in the garage. He also added a couple jugs of motor oil, power steering fluid, and antifreeze to the van, stuffing the jugs into any small space he could find. A couple of rolls of duct tape and electrical tape finished his preparations. As he was wrapping things up, the smell of cooking meat caught his nose, and he wandered out to the back porch. Bob was at the grill, cigarette in his teeth, a beer in one hand, and a barbecue fork in the other.
"Thought we'd have another steak before we hit the road," he said as Gene came out.
Gene plucked a beer from a small tin tub full of ice sitting on the table. It was the last 18-pack from the garage. No sense wasting it.
"Sounds good to me. I think the van is as ready as I can make it."
Daniel looked up.
"What do you mean? There's nothing wrong with the van."
Taking a tug on his beer, Gene smiled.
"No, there's not. And now I know there isn't."
Christy came out the door with a large bowl in her hands and set it on the table.
"I made a salad, sort of. Bob, you really should eat more vegetables."
Bob snorted.
"Lions and tigers don't eat vegetables. Vegetables are what my food eats."
Taking a beer for herself, Christy replied,
"Lions and tigers don't have high blood pressure or cholesterol. You should take better care of yourself."
"Christy, my dear, none of us gets out of this thing we call life alive. We're all going to die. I'd rather die with a belly full of meat than kale."
Gene saluted the statement with his beer.
"Amen, brother."
When the steaks were done, Bob piled them on a plate and set them on the table. Then he disappeared into the house. He came back out with an atlas in hand and sat down. He laid the map book on the table and opened it.
"Let's get the first part of our route planned out here," he said.
Teague took a plate and stabbed a steak with a fork.
"You do that. I'm going to eat."
Without looking up, Bob said,
"You should let the steak rest."
Teague snorted.
"It can rest in my gut."
And he sat down to get to work.
"I gotta say one thing, Bob. You have fine taste in meat. These ribeyes are awesome."
The group, except for Teague, who was too busy eating, gathered around